Joshua chapter 1 and verse 1. It says, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' aide, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I'm about to give to them, to the Israelites. I will give you every place where you set your foot, as I promised Moses. Your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon and from the great river of the Euphrates on all the Hittite country to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. No one will be able to stand against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their ancestors to give them. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Keep this book of the law always on your lips. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. For the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. So Joshua ordered the officers of the people, go through the camp and tell the people, get your provisions ready. 3 days from now you will cross the Jordan here to go in to take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you for your own. But to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, Joshua said, remember the command that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you after he said, the Lord your God will give you rest by giving you this land. Your wives, your children, and your livestock may stay in the land that Moses gave you, east of the Jordan. But all your fighting men, ready for battle, must cross over ahead of you, ahead of your fellow Israelites. You are to help them until the Lord gives them rest, as he's done for you, until they too have taken possession of the land that the Lord your God is giving them. After that, you may go back and occupy your own land, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you east of the Jordan towards the sunrise. Then they answered Joshua, whatever you've commanded us, we will do, and wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we fully obeyed Moses, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your word and does not obey it, whatever you may command them, will be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. We started last week looking at Joshua 1 and trying to give some thought to transitions. Because the nature of life is it changes. Things change. And at the moment, it's very obvious things are changing in our nation. And I guess that one of the questions that get asked when something ends is, what happens now? What now? Moses is dead. The man who has led this nation out of Egypt and round the wilderness for 40 years. He's a man who has great reputation. You go back to Deuteronomy 34 and verse 12. No one has ever shown the mighty power or performed the awesome deeds that Moses did in the sight of all Israel. He's got a great reputation. And for all of these people, he's always been their leader. Because a whole generation dies in the wilderness. So he's always been there. So what now? God called Moses miraculously in the burning bush. Exodus 3 and verse 7. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of Israel has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. It's a very explicit and clear statement about God's intent and who he's sending. He's going to bring the Israelites to a land flowing with milk and honey. But now he's dead. Moses is dead. And what's interesting to me, and the thing I want to talk to you about, is God is not asking the question, what now? God's not wondering what to do. God doesn't come down from heaven and meet with Joshua and go, Joshua, what's your vision? What's your intentions? Where would you like this to go? He's not consulting him about a plan. Joshua doesn't even go to God and say, God, I've got this great idea. Would you bless it? I've got these really good plans. I've had 40 years of watching Moses to get my thoughts in order, and I've decided that this is what we should do. Will you bless what I'm doing? God shows up with a very clear plan about what happens now. Moses, my servant, is dead. Now you and all these people, get ready to cross the Jordan into the land I'm giving you. Because the plan didn't start with Moses, and the plan didn't end with Moses. Genesis 12, God tells Abraham he's going to give him the land of Canaan. In Genesis 15, he sets it out more clearly. Genesis 15 and verse 18 says, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham and said, to your descendants I give this land from the Wadi of Egypt to the great river of the Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Raphaites, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites. And hundreds of years later, Moses is called. Hundreds of years later. Exodus 12 and verse 40 says, the time that the people of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. If I take 430 years ago from the day, that puts us in 1592. And give some context to that. Shakespeare is alive. America doesn't exist. The word British doesn't exist. Because whilst England and Wales have formed some union earlier that century, Scotland's still its own kingdom. And I don't fully think I have the capacity to conceive of what life is like there 430 years ago. I imagine if I turned up with what I have on my person now, I would be assumed to be an alien. Oh, what's that you've got in your pocket? It's a phone. What's a phone? Well, in a few hundred years from now, a guy's going to invent a way for you to pick up a device and speak to people on the end of it. But then 100 years later from that, we're going to get mobile phones. And you don't need a wire. And then as technology develops, I can go on the internet. What's the internet? I might pull out my wallet, show them my debit card. What on earth is that? And actually, life 430 years ago is sort of difficult to imagine for us. 430 years. I'm assuming I'd be boiled in a pot, or as I turned up with my iPhone and my debit cards, assumed to be some kind of witch. And because we don't even speak the same language.
No.
They're speaking Shakespearean English, and I have done a bit of Shakespeare in school. I have no idea half the time what's happening in Shakespeare's plays. And all of their official documents are done in Latin. So I'm stuffed. 430 years. And yet God is crystal clear from the outset. In Genesis 15 and verse 13, God says to Abraham, "Know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated." I have some information about 1592. And even with that little information, it is hard for me in my head to conceive what life would look like. I have no idea what 2422 looks like. Because God's planning things on a different level than we often give any conscious thought to. God doesn't panic when Moses dies. He's not even slightly concerned. He's not worried about what happens. "No, Joshua, you get the people ready because you're going into the land I promised to give you." Because God's been working his plan out in the life of his people for generations. And an awful lot of that has been incredibly messy. God calls Abraham when he's 75. Tells him he's going to have descendants more numerous than the stars. And those descendants are the ones that are going to inherit the land. When Abraham gets to 85... and there's still no children. Sarah has a good plan. "Take my slave. Have a child with Hagar. Maybe that's it." So Abraham does that. And Ishmael's born. And God's crystal clear, Ishmael is not the child of the promise. So he's not even counted in the descendants that are apparently going to inherit the land. Abraham's 100 when Isaac's born. It's been 25 years.
Yeah.
That's difficult for most of us to live with. God promised something and he took 25 years for it to arrive. But that's where it ends. It's just Isaac. God's promised descendants. And there's one child. There's one. Everything falls into his hands. Let's hope he's fruitful. Because there's a lot of people who have to be born for this to be more numerous than the stars in the sky and the sand on the beach. So let's hope. You know, octoplets, Lord. Come on. And Isaac gives birth to Esau and Jacob, two brothers who do not like each other. And it's a messy relationship. And the mum's involved in the messiness. And she encourages Jacob to deceive his own father as he's dying. This is not healthy family times. And Jacob has the most messed up family situation in the world. Married to two sisters who effectively compete with each other. And Leah's hope for Jacob's favour is just to produce children. And in the midst of it, their slaves are involved. So children are born into this totally dysfunctional family. Who do you call mum out of the four women? It's not nice. It's not healthy. It's not all really pleasant or good. And Joseph's born. And because he's Rachel's child, he's the favourite. That's the level. Because it's the other sister's daughter. And his brothers hate him for it. Hate him. And then there's this very coincidental day in Joseph's life. His dad sends him to check on his brothers. And he goes to the place where he expects his brothers to be. The brothers are not there. But there happens to be a man who saw where the brothers were and overheard where they were heading. Well, that's awfully convenient, isn't it? What's the man doing there? It's awfully convenient. So he strides off to the place this man has informed him his brothers are. And as they see him coming, they decide they're killing him. Except one of the brothers is not so keen on that idea. Wants to try and save Joseph's life. So says, look, we won't get anything. Let's just beat him up. There's no benefit to killing him. And though his intention is to save him, it just so happens an Ishmaelite caravan's passing. And they can sell the brother, Joseph, into slavery. This is totally messed up. This is ugly on all levels. But at least Abraham had a son, right? Like, he's had a descendant. Like, you know, maybe it's that. Joseph sold into slavery, goes to Potiphar's house, gets falsely accused of being a sex offender. Put into prison, sits in prison, meets someone that he hopes will get him out of prison. They forget him until they remember him. And suddenly Joseph's the Prime Minister of Egypt. But then, in the aftermath of that, the whole family's brought into Egypt. But a Pharaoh takes the throne that doesn't know God. And oppresses the Israelite people. How on earth does any of that look like God fulfilling his promise to Abraham? When they've been there for 430 years, Moses shows up. Let my people go. But now Moses is dead. The guy who's taken on Egypt single-handedly almost. Who's gone into Pharaoh and gone, listen, you need to do this. Or God. God will get you. And it's amazing how narrow our view of life is sometimes. Because for hundreds of years, God's been outworking his purpose to bring about the promise he made to Abraham. And yet I feel like if God says something to me and I have to wait more than a few months for it, he's failed me. I feel like if I'm waiting years, maybe I misheard him, maybe I misunderstood, maybe I misinterpreted. I start every new season going, what now? And the staggering thing is, even in the dysfunction and mess, God's having his way. Joseph makes a staggering statement in Genesis 50 in verse 20. It's staggering. He turns to his brothers and he says, you meant this for evil, but God meant it for good, to bring about a great deliverance. Isn't it incredible that God can take the evil intent of brothers and use it to position someone perfectly, that a nation might be brought up in safety of another superpower with the freedom to expand? They went in as a family of brothers and came out as a nation. Because God took the evil intent of brothers and used it for good. It's incredible. Isn't it incredible that God takes the evil intent of Pharaoh towards the Israelites to bring Moses up in a palace to show him the way of kings? And when Moses murders, God takes him into the wilderness. But it's there he's calling him back. And I don't think Sometimes we give God enough credit. Because we look at the little momentary details of our lives. And how we're feeling on a particular day. And if there's not a specific thing we know that's being outworked in our lives, we're not sure anything's being outworked in our lives. If there's not something that's crystal clear that God has said, and we can really feel it in us, we're not utterly confident that anything, God's doing really anything with us. And when things get messy, we're absolutely confident God's not doing something. Because how could he in the mess of things? There's a interesting reality in the story of Exodus. God hardens Pharaoh's heart. God hardens Pharaoh's heart. Pharaoh, who doesn't serve God, who has no consideration for his ways, who has built other gods, God has the capacity to harden his heart. And in Exodus 12 and verse 36, it says, "The Lord made the Egyptians generous to the people, and they gave them what they asked for. So the Israelites stripped Egypt of its wealth." The Lord made them generous. I serve a God this morning who doesn't need people to invite him into their life to affect the outcome of what they do. God has the capacity to harden Pharaoh's heart without Pharaoh ever asking for God's influence in his life. God has the capacity to make the Egyptians give the Israelites whatever they ask for without the Egyptians ever inviting God to be their God. There's a fascinating statement in Habakkuk 1 and verse 6 where God says he is raising up the Babylonians. Not for pleasant, happy times. Not because they've acknowledged he's God. But because he's outworking his purpose in the earth. And God doesn't need me to get caught up in the fact, well, they're not going to do what God wants them to do, and I'm going to have to panic now because I don't know how this plays out. He has the capacity to intervene in the lives of people without them ever inviting him to. I think that's staggering. But here's the other reality. He is outworking purpose that is far bigger than my capacity to comprehend. Yeah. Ephesians 1 tells me I was chosen in him before the foundations of the world. Before the foundations of the world. I don't think I've got the capacity to continue 430 years ago. Though there is information available about the time, though we have some idea of what the world looked like, though we can have a rough idea of what things were sort of like, I don't feel like I can actually get myself there. Nobody knows what it was like before the foundation of the world. No. Nobody's got any capacity to tell you in any detail what that looked like. Millennia before I ever came into existence, He chose me. So I don't imagine God's asking himself, what now? I don't think the heavenly hosts gathered the Trinity sitting around a table discussing, I wonder what Charles will be like as king. I wonder if Liz Truss's economic plan will work out. I wonder what happens next. He makes known the end from the beginning. And as life changes and things look uncertain, my confidence is in a planning God. Who can work through dysfunction and mess? Who can use people who have no intention of turning their hearts towards him or acknowledging his existence? Who can take evil intent and use it for good? He is the God who has the capacity to make all things work together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. All things. Does it always feel like that? No. Is that always the verse my heart is drawn towards? No. But it is the reality of who he is. And there's a more staggering version of this, in my opinion. Because in Genesis chapter 3, God makes crystal clear his intent to send his seed into the earth. He tells the devil, I will send my seed. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel. And the Jewish people wait for a long time for a Messiah. And it's a very long time. But it didn't ever mean Christ wasn't coming. And Acts chapter 2 tells me lawless men put him to death on a cross. But that was entirely the purpose of God. because it was the cross that bore my freedom. And so as we give some thought to transitions and think about life being different in the future and how things change and the uncertainty of all of that with a new king and a new government, and I want to assure you, God is not in heaven asking himself what now. He's not wondering how this plays out or how it's outworked. I'm going to suggest to you that God said some things to people in 1592 that he's still outworking. And the people who seem like they're getting in the way, and the stuff that seems like it's in opposition to what God wants to do, maybe he's using them. Maybe he's bringing his purpose about through them. I don't think there's a more reassuring place to be. Than to come to the one who's working out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will. So Moses dies. And God says to Joshua, now you get ready. Because the plan didn't start with Moses, the plan doesn't end with Moses. And I don't know how the details of your life work out. And I don't know what happens. But I'm assured he's got a plan.